Welcome to the CLT Podcast, a series all about things related to learning and teaching in higher education, brought to you by the Centre for Learning and Teaching at Leeds Beckett University. In this episode, listen to Professor Divine Chirura and Kate Grafton as they talk about compassionate approaches to learning and teaching. Wherever you may be listening from, we hope you enjoy. Welcome to the CLT Podcast. I'm Andy Bedford. I'm an educational developer in the Centre for Learning and Teaching here at Leeds Beckett University. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Professor of Counselling Psychology at York St John's University, Professor Divine Chirura, and Principal Lecturer in Physiotherapy for the School of Health at Leeds Beckett University, and National Teaching Fellow Kate Grafton. Divine, Kate, welcome back to the CLT Podcast.
Hi,
thank you very much.
Our learning and teaching community is hugely enriched by the diverse and different students and staff that we have attached to in this HE environment. They arrive with a vast range of experiences and a vast range of abilities as well. It's especially important that we consider those who may feel excluded by our conventional approaches to learning and teaching, so that all of the students and all of the staff feel a sense of belonging to their course, to their fellow students, to their staff, to the community. What do we need to do then to ensure that those who may feel excluded by these approaches feel a sense of belonging, and how do you go approaching that on your courses?
So, you know, students come with such a wide range of experiences now. It's not the same as when I qualified, and it's not the same as even 5 or 6 years ago at university. I think the pandemic has really changed our perspectives, and I think we need to understand that and be prepared to support the students, particularly in level four, when they're coming with, you know, no experience perhaps of working in groups, very little experience of communication, of all of the things that we took for granted before. They perhaps don't have that now. And do we need to help them actually more in those first few weeks at university, develop those skills that we always took for granted? So I'm thinking of things like academic resilience, how they actually just be at university. What is it to be part of a community? And I know, certainly in my area in physiotherapy, we do a lot of work to try and, you know, make people feel welcome and part of our profession early. So things like buddying them up quickly, socials really, you know, within the first week of term, trying to pair people up with someone who's in a similar background or experience or from a similar place as them, if it's, you know, if it's appropriate and they want to do that, and trying to make the first, you know, term in university as stress-free as we can. We know that a lot of students drop out of university after Christmas, when they've had that kind of first term and its assessments. So what can we do as a team to try and make that as stress-free as possible? And is it about giving them an early bite-sized formative assessment that is risk-free? Is it about looking at the whole first year kind of experience? Do they need to have lots of summative assessments? Or is it about building those skills of, you know, being part of a group, being part of a team, communication skills? Is it about building? And I hate the term soft skills. I really hate that because they're really important skills. But for us, our students go on placement in their second year, so we need to get them confident and happy with all of the basic stuff before we let them, you know, into the scarier world of the NHS and work. So for me, it's about starting as we mean to go on, and how can we make them feel part of a community? And that is a really different community to what it used to be when, you know, when I trained.
Excellent. Just picking up on a few things that you mentioned there as well, Kate. I love the idea of buddying up and having somebody that they can connect with, especially in those sort of transition stages from whatever background they've come from, be that straight from school or be they've had a bit of time away from school or whatever education system they've come from, and having somebody else that they can talk to about things that aren't necessarily all just to do with academic problems, academic issues, but things that can help to feel connected within this university higher education community.
Yeah, and it's an opt-in. We don't force people to make friends. It's, you know, we ask them, you know, who would be a useful person for them to be able to speak to. And if it's someone who's got kids, you know, we have students on our course who have kids who can talk about, you know, the challenges of having a family, along with the challenges of trying to study for quite an intense degree. Or if they're from, you know, a different background, well away from Leeds, you know, how can we make that easier for them? And can knowing somebody who's gone through a similar experience to you can make such a difference.
Yeah, I was smiling as Kate was speaking, because I agree with everything that Kate has said. And then I remember watching a YouTube clip that's been trending of a young man who stood up facing his teacher in a classroom, and he's walking out. And as he walks out, the teacher says something like, go out and then you can come back if you've calmed down. And he responds very calmly, and he says, if you want kids to feel involved, if you want us to feel connected, make this class interesting and a place where we feel we belong. And he walked out. And so this is a precursor to saying, for me, I agree with all the practical things that are so important around compassionate, containing, and the practical early actions that we can take, as Kate has said, to help students in their journey and to help them to feel part of a community and to create those conditions for connection and transition. But coming back to the story I told, I think it has to come back to us looking at ourselves as well, because we can easily point out to those students out there, those first years or those returning students, but actually I think it's important. And why we should look at ourselves, I think we should look at our own philosophy, at our own thoughts about connection and belonging. So if I give an example, I've thought a lot about Ubuntu philosophy, which is from African philosophy for me, which is at the heart about humanity, community, and belonging. And it's a humanistic approach that is focused on creating empowering learning spaces that affirm and that treat students as dignified persons, regardless of their difference or with their difference. And it argues that all students, and in fact, colleagues as well, can excel if their humanity is placed at the center of their learning and if they feel a sense of belonging. So for me, I think, what does that look like? Fostering a safe learning environment is important. I think the setting of boundaries is important, a real clarity of what we expect, because sometimes people have never been to university before, it's the first time, or if they've been, it's a different program, it's a different course, it's a different year. Introducing unifying activities, so ice-breaking activities, buddying up schemes, as already has been said, maybe with students who are in like the year, the cohort above, or who've been on the program for longer, if it's a blended course. And then lastly, having activities that enable collaboration and co-creative learning from a position of compassion and love to meet the diverse student needs. So that's what I'll say. It's a two-way process, our positioning, and then thinking through about the practical and environment.
I like how you say about that empowering learning spaces and being sort of empathetic to create a sense of belonging. I wonder how many teachers go into a space and feel that they need to teach rather than they go into a space and feel that the learners need to learn, and having that sort of, how do I create an environment which is one which is conducive to my learners learning rather than creating an environment which is one which allows me to teach.
Do you know, Andy, I would also add just there, I love all the stuff that Divine's saying. I think a lot of us and a lot of our students have lost their love of learning. The joy of learning has been sapped out of them through school and college and, you know, through having to do a lot of dry activities that, you know, and it can be, it's our role, I think, to try and instill that love of learning again. And, you know, there's nothing that makes my heart sink more than stepping into somewhere and seeing it's a 3-hour PowerPoint presentation, you know, and that's it. That's just not me. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. It's not for me. But I think it's how do we engage the students and how can we give them some kind of ownership of their learning? How can we get them to be involved? The idea of co-creation is great. It's hard to do. It's really hard to do. And a lot of the structures that we are kind of bound by in the university make it challenging to be able to do that, really. Certainly giving students choice in their assessments and choice in kind of their delivery and learning, you know, it's great to try and plan it in there, but sometimes practically that can be really challenging. But, you know, if we can instill that joy and make them want to and be excited about their learning, I think that's half the battle won.
What can we do then? What practical steps can we do to create this exciting learning environment and this exciting space where students feel that their environment is compassionate and addresses their needs?
Well, one of my favorite quotes that has inspired the way I approach compassionate teaching and spaces comes from the anthropologist Ruth Beha, who says, "One thing remains constant about our humanity, that we must never stop trying to tell stories of who we think we are. Equally, we must never stop wanting to listen to each other's stories. If we ever stopped, it would all be over." And this is I love this quote, and it's from Ruth Beha's work, Ethnography and the Book That Was Lost. Because in a way, I see part of how we learn in the pedagogy and being when we're children and so on is through stories, through narratives. You know, if you think for kids, what they love most kids is story time, you know, it's exciting, you know, because there's a learning in it. And somehow we lose the capacity to learn and to play, or not the capacity, I think we still have the capacity, but we lose opportunities, actually, maybe that's a better way to put it, in which we can play and in which we can hear stories. So whenever I've taught, I always think rather than just teach about empathy and being genuine as a psychologist and risk assessment, how can I bring in examples from practice in which I've learned stories? How can I invite the learners to share stories from their placements? Confidentiality held, of course, and all that. Yeah. Because herein lies a real opportunity to open up our capacity to learn. How can we tell our own stories, our own experiences? And that brings in then the aspect of diversity and difference. So I would say for me, that's one of the tips I've learned to make it a space in which we look forward, because we never forget stories, do we? Or if we do, we think we can remember it was a great story. Yeah. So I'll pause at that, you know, opportunities for creativity in the room, sharing of narratives is important, and co-creative learning, again, is important by sharing those narratives and experiences.
I would just add to that as well, something that I've found I've done more so over the last few years is be honest about my vulnerabilities and about my downfalls. You know, I am not a perfect physiotherapist. I have done some really daft things in my time. And actually to be open about that with the students, you know, makes them see me as a real human being and probably gives me more credibility than somebody who, you know, doesn't admit to their kind of faults, as it were. So I think sharing the stories and seeing, you know, allowing the students to see that, you know, you have lived and that you, you know, have a life and that, you know, for me, I have quite some significant other things going off in my life that impact on me day to day is really important, especially as I'm, you know, trying to teach healthcare students. I want them to have that with their patients. So if we can have that, you know, within our cohorts and with the staff, they're going to have that naturally with their patients, hopefully.
The way that we develop and learn is by questioning things, by learning from mistakes, by not getting it necessarily correct the first way round, but sharing our understanding, our learning from that, and devising plans, ways and methods of moving forwards. And that really fits me with me with that kind of that compassion that we can bring within the classroom as well.
Students always laugh when I tell them I failed my dissertation. You know, and they can't believe it. They're like, but you work in academia. And I'm like, yeah, but, you know, look where I am. Despite this, you know, huge failure at the time, look where I am. It didn't stop me in the end. This is what I learned from it. And I think that really makes a lot of our third year stop and think and, you know, realise that in the grand scheme of things, you know, it's important, but it's not gonna, you know, destroy their lives.
So do we need to then think about our interactions with students and our interactions with our colleagues and other staff in our higher education settings? Do we need to consider listening? Do we need to consider things such as kindness and promotion of well-being as well?
What I would like to do is to, and more and more as a psychologist and as a person, I'm interested in the etiology of words, because we tend to fall in a trap of talking about a load of words and then we all have different meanings, and of course we will. And I was part of a group just the other week, actually, where somebody said, it's a reflective group on compassionate teaching. And somebody, two people in the group said, I absolutely hate the word compassion and I don't agree with it in relation to teaching. It's a kind of fluffy word. What is it? You know, people are coming to class to learn and they should crack on with it, you know. So I gave a lot of compassion to what was being said. So I want to come back to it. And I said, well, actually, I love the word compassion. You know, some of my writing is on love and compassion. And I'm not a Latin or Greek speaker, but the etiology in terms of going back to the root meanings of those words, for me, I understand that passion coming from Latin passio or pati, which means I think to suffer, and then the com starting compassion, it means to suffer together. So coming full circle to what you said, for me there's something about having a real empathy for the experience of learning and the suffering, the pain, the stretching that it brings for the learner. If we can position ourselves to begin to understand what it's like to be away from home, you know, I was a 19-year-old at Leeds Uni myself, and then at Leeds Beckett, away from my family, in a city I'd not been to before. And thankfully I've stayed and have loved it, and it's nearly 30 years, but there's something about having that capacity to listen, to be empathic. And the last bit I'll say about compassion, and Jazieri's work says that compassion is a multidimensional process that comprises four key components: an awareness of the suffering, so that might be the cognitive and having an empathic awareness, how hard it is to learn to reference, to look at all these books and think, will I ever get there? Then the second thing is sympathetic concern that's relating to being emotionally moved by the experience. So this is where the narratives come in and the sharing. And then the third is a real wish to see the relief of the suffering, or in other words, to see success. You know, I always say to trainees, trainee psychologists and psychotherapists, I'm not here to fail you. That's not the persona that you should see. I'm here to help you to learn. And then lastly, a responsiveness or readiness to help, to motivate and to inspire in the classroom. So I really like that. So for me, that's what I would say in relation to well-being. And if we have those components, I think that can position us in a place where those facilitated conditions for learning and optimal learning emerge.
I think for me, we are so goal-driven in life, in university, you know, meet the learning objectives, you know, meet this, pass this, reach this goal by this point. And I've turned so far away from that, as you can imagine. I think a lot more about values and about what kind of human being do I want to be? And it takes off a lot of the pressure. You know, what kind of teacher do I want to be? What kind of role model do I want to be? And that's helped me an awful lot with, you know, a lot of life-changing experiences. And I've tried to model that with my personal tutors, academic advisees, to try and help them reduce that anxiety that all our students have about they have to achieve this. What if they fail? What? They get so, you know, hung up on the what ifs. And actually, by just changing that kind of perspective from goals and objectives to actually, what kind of physiotherapist do you want to be to your patient? I think that takes, you know, the pressure off and helps reduce some of that anxiety. I'm always going to go from a practical point of view. I'm a physiotherapist. It's kind of in me like a stick of rock. I think we also have to get the support systems right. You know, I am not a counsellor. I think there's people that can do that far better than me. So I think it's about knowing who is the right person to refer students onto for the support networks that they might need, whether that's with academic skills or whether it's with pastoral care. I think, you know, as the academic member of staff, there's some things that I can do really, really well, but we need to have those support structures in the university in place and be able to know who to send students to get that best advice quickly and early, and to make sure that students and staff have that support available, know where to go, who to go to, and to you know what to do when things start to go pear-shaped. Because invariably, if you can nip things in the bud, it makes things an awful lot easier than waiting and waiting and waiting. So yeah, support systems.
Fantastic. Staff that's the sort of new to teaching as well can find it quite daunting in the classroom when it comes to trying to create that sort of environment. And as you mentioned there, Kate, they often need a support system behind them to help. What sort of work have you done with colleagues that has helped them to be more compassionate with their teaching and creating their learning environments?
Well, I think it's about having a mentoring system in place and having somebody that you can go to have those daft chats. You know, how to get into Blackboard? You know, what is Collaborate? Especially at the time where a lot of staff have joined us through the pandemic and haven't actually ever met their teams. And I don't think we're still at a stage where teams are really getting together because people are coming in, doing the teaching and going home again. So it's about how we make them feel part of a team. Professional development have got some wonderful, wonderful things. They've just updated all of that, and it's about directing people to those. I'm going to say CLT because I'm part of the CLT family. I think we have some great staff in there, some really good educational resources. You know, DEEP is fantastic, the developing excellent academic practice, the resources and the, you know, things that are available to you. It's hard though when you're busy and, you know, you've got your nose to the grindstone to actually access some of those things. But in my experience, by chatting and finding out that additional support and just asking for help, you know, It makes life a lot easier. And again, the sooner you nip something in the bud, the easier it is, and the better teacher you will be, and the happier you will be in what is a very challenging and demanding job that can feel quite isolating at times. So it's out there, but it's how you access that support, knowing that it's there. You know, when someone says to me after 2 or 3 years working at the university, how do I find CLT? I think, oh my goodness. Oh my goodness, how have you not found CLT? Let me show you the way. This golden archway is here.
But once you're in, that's it. It's,
no escape.
Paved roads, yeah. Do we need to reconsider how we teach then to be more compassionate, or do we just need to have a bit more of a an awareness of being in this environment, being with these range and diverse backgrounds and abilities and students and so on? Do we need to do anything different when it comes to interacting?
Well, I was listening very carefully, because I was nodding and smiling as you were speaking, Kate, about kind of the importance of help. And then I was reminded of the work of James Derunian on inspirational teaching in higher education. I think there's a paper that he did in 2017. What does it look like? What does it look, sound, and feel like? And off the back of that, and one of three of the things in that really important paper was a lot of the students who participated in the research stated that what they thought was inspirational courses or programs were motivating, number one. Number two, they were encouraging. And number three, they were flowing from the teacher's passion for their subject. So myself and other colleagues, at least Beckett, I think, Alan Smith, who's one of the National Teaching Fellows, and another colleague, Paul Nicholson, we gathered data at one of the events that the Center for Teaching and Learning was doing. And we asked our colleagues, I think there's about 30 academics or more in the room, in tables, and we asked them, what might this look like? And I think this applies to compassionate teaching. And they came up with 10 things that I'm going to say very quickly, and then I'll add one more. So they said that it was important, if we are to have in an environment that's inspirational, and I think that is compassionate, that number one, we should have passion for the subject. Number two, we should support problem solving. Number three, we should be able to make real life cases apply to disciplinary knowledge and research to really change people's lives for the better. And I think that fits what you were saying, Kate, about, you know, telling a story. As a physiotherapist myself, I tell stories as a psychologist, you know, where I've done well or where I've gone, I could have done better there, you know. Number four, using a story to grab attention. Number five, being responsive to learners' needs and respecting boundaries. Number six, importance of stressing learning outside of class. The learning goes on in classroom. This is just to further the stimulus of your learning, but it goes on. Number seven, being really interested in individuals, not just learners. I really feel passionate about that, you know, getting to know the learners as people, their experiences and so on. Number eight, showing care and concern. That's really important in the world that we're living in, you know, where psychological distress and stress, you know, difficulties financially, difficulties on things that can, you know, really impact all of us. Number nine, showing humanity is another thing that came up, and I think that's deeply important. And number 10, listening and taking action. I think is so important. The one I would add, given the talk we've had and that I've learned myself, is always being willing to learn ourselves, being open to change and adapt, and to always ask for help and support ourselves when we need it. equals having self-compassion. So that's what I would say. You know, I never shy away from asking. You know, so there we go. I'll pause at that.
Fantastic. Some really good advice there. And I love those 11 points that you've just mentioned to us. It takes us on quite nicely to our podcast challenge. And so I wonder if you can think of a challenge for our podcast listeners based upon what we've been discussing today, that they could try within their own teaching and learning practices, and they could try out themselves. I wonder if you've got one each.
So mine is something that we did as part of our revalidation. We went through revalidation earlier this year, and it's about trying to build in choice, student choice, into your modules, into your curriculum. Is there any way that on a simple level you could offer a choice of assessment titles or assessment types? Could they do one thing or another? Could you offer choice in their handing date or choice of their delivery? Do they want to be online, or would actually they like to be face to face? Got to be quite brave with that. You've got to think ahead, but there are some quite simple things that you can do that can help students feel that they have some kind of choice and ownership of their learning.
Fantastic. Thank you for that one, Kate. Divine, do you have a challenge?
Oh, gosh, that is a challenge in itself because there's so much. But I was thinking of a couple of things. The first is around questions that we can ask learners. And yesterday I heard a really lovely question which fits with the idea of compassion and belonging. And it says, you know, you would ask students, trainees, can you think and reflect on something that you have changed your worldview on, that you were so fixed on, but now through the learning, this has helped you to accept the humanity and the difference of others more? And I think I would like to ask that, which fits into the second thing, to ask that of our colleagues. Can you think of something that you've changed your mind on and worldview as an academic that you were so fixed on? This is how we should do it. But now it has helped you to be more compassionate and to accept the humanity of the learners and their position more. So I'll pause at that, because I think that really COVID taught us to reflect on that. For me, it was online learning. Years ago, I'd written about online learning. It's good when we're using Adobe Connect and other, you know, but I'm going a long way there, Kate.
Long way back there.
It is. But actually, you know, I've had to change my worldview about online learning and how it's open. So yeah, so for me, it's the fundamental question, which is about changing our worldview and being more accepting to the diversity and difference of others.
Divine, Kate, thank you ever so much for joining me today. It's been wonderful to talk to you both. And thank you for sharing your insights, your experiences, and your tips and knowledge with the CLT podcast listeners.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
To listen to more in our podcast series, click on the subscribe button. And to keep up to date with the Centre for Learning and Teaching at Leeds Beckett University, follow us on Twitter @LeedsBeckettCLT. Thank you for tuning in.